Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Big changes are underway for sex education in California. Two new laws signed last month by Governor Brown introduced some potentially controversial changes for public high schools in the state. One of the laws makes sexual health education mandatory for public school students in grades 7 through 12, though parents have the ability to opt out. Aimed at standardizing the curriculum, it requires sex education classes to include information about sexual harassment, sexual assault, adolescent relationship abuse, intimate partner violence, and sex trafficking. Schools must also provide comprehensive, accurate, and unbiased information on sexual health and HIV prevention and provide students with the knowledge and skills they need to develop healthy attitudes concerning adolescent growth and development, body image, gender, sexual orientation, relationships, marriage, and family. Perhaps more controversial, the second law requires school districts that already include health as a graduation requirement to teach about sexual violence prevention and the Yes Means Yes sexual consent standard. Under the Yes Means Yes or affirmative consent standard, sexual activity is only considered to be consensual when both partners clearly state their affirmative, conscious, and voluntary agreement at every stage of the sexual encounter. While other states have introduced this standard for college-aged students, California is the first state in the nation to require lessons about sexual consent for high school students. While these laws are new, sexual health education is not, and tonight's guests have been on the front lines educating local teens about these matters for years. Joining me now in the studio to talk about the new laws and to share their expertise in teaching sex education to high school students are Christopher Pepper, a teacher on special assignment with the San Francisco Unified School District, where he helps coordinate the district's high school sexuality education and HIV prevention efforts. He has taught thousands of students in San Francisco schools and frequently writes and speaks about issues related to health and sexuality education. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're also joined in the studio by Shafia Zaloom. She's a teacher and administrator, in Bay Area schools for 20 years, and she is currently a health educator at the Urban School, a private school here in San Francisco, where she oversees and creates all student and parent health education. Topics include a wide range from media literacy, body image and substances, to human sexuality, identity formation, and personal integrity. In addition, she recently published the High School Companion Curriculum Guide for the documentary The Hunting Ground, a film that focuses on the pervasive problem of sexual assault on college campuses. Welcome, Shafia.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're also joined in the studio by Hannah Pastrano. She is a City College student who works as a peer educator for Expect Respect San Francisco. Expect Respect, in collaboration with 16 community-based organizations, offers healthy relationship workshops to every freshman health class in the San Francisco Unified School District. She's also worked with youth in the city as a violence prevention specialist and peer counselor, providing support and advocacy to survivors of intimate partner violence and sexual assault. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you so much.
And finally, by phone, we are joined by Sophie Karasik. She is an anti-sexual violence activist and a co-founder of End Rape on Campus, a nonprofit organization working to end sexual violence on college campuses. Prior to her graduation from UC Berkeley in 2015, she spearheaded several federal complaints against the school. Sophie has also been a leading advocate for California's affirmative consent law. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to be part of the conversation. We'll be opening our phone lines in about 15 minutes, and you can call this number, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You could email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at CityVisions, KALW. So, Sophie Karasik, I wanted to start with you. You're going to be with us for the first 10 minutes or so of the program. And you, as an advocate for the legislation that just was signed into law, have a particular perspective on how this all came to be. So tell us about the affirmative consent law and how it came to be and why you think it's important.
Sure. So thank you so much for doing this, having this really important conversation. The Yes Means Yes law that was first signed in California was related to the affirmative consent yes means yes standard for college campuses. And so that was signed into law last fall. And this past fall, yes means yes, as you mentioned, for high school students, was recently passed. And we are incredibly happy as survivors of campus sexual assault to see this issue being addressed on levels that are before college, as is unfortunately evident in the hunting ground, and also as has been shown in many recent news articles, the epidemic of campus sexual assault is just completely unacceptable. And it's really important that we have these conversations starting earlier on in high school and perhaps even in middle school and prior to that about consent and healthy relationships, what sexual assault looks like, and ensuring that that's age-appropriate material that folks are learning about. It's way too late to be starting only in college, and the Center for Disease Control has shown that the most effective education is education that is sustained over a longer period of time and that is done in small group settings. And so it's a perfect time in high school and middle school to start to have these important conversations.
So tell us exactly what affirmative consent means. I said, you know, and you've said it, yes means yes, but what exactly are we talking about here?
Right. So it is ensuring that there's a conscious and voluntary, affirmative, enthusiastic agreement between people who want to engage in some sexual activity. So some ways that consent cannot be indicated are if someone is incapacitated or if someone is asleep. So that's something that commonly happens on college campuses and also in high school, unfortunately, is that people end up being sexually assaulted by perpetrators who take advantage of them while they were either asleep or coming in and out of consciousness or are intoxicated. And so this standard is incredibly important for ensuring that we can hold perpetrators accountable for sexual assault that is committed under those circumstances. So not only do we have that standard in place, but also now students will be educated about it. So it's not enough to only have one prong, but to have everything, have education also addressed.
I see. I'm hearing some feedback back there. If you have the radio on, you need to turn that off. Sorry. Are you still there? I think we lost her. I think we lost Sophie. We're going to try to get her back because there's a few more questions I had for her. But let's pick up with the rest of our guests here in the studio. So Shafia Zaloom, you've been engaging your students,
yes,
at the Urban School, a private school here in San Francisco, on this topic of affirmative consent, I guess even before it was law. Tell us what made you go there, and you didn't need to wait till it became law. Why was it important for you to bring that into the school?
Well, I think in any comprehensive sexuality education course, we're going to be talking about what it means to have healthy relationships, how to educate others on how to treat you and how to listen for how others want to be treated. And that's an essential element of healthy relationships, you know, in all the relationships we have, whether they're sexual or platonic. And so it's a really important aspect of adolescent development that kids have that understanding. And so it's a natural component of a comprehensive sexuality education. And that's why. So I think that those of us who have been teaching sex ed in that way for a long time have been talking about this. We just haven't called it what legislation has now named it, which is the yes means yes affirmative consent.
Okay. And thank you for that. We'll get more into what that actually means and how that takes shape in the classroom. But we have Sophie back on the line. Sophie, can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah, sorry about that.
No problem. All right. So continuing then in our conversation, you mentioned that your concern was that it's never too early to start, or we haven't been starting early enough, perhaps, is probably the better way to say this. Say more about that. Why seventh graders?
Sure. So I wasn't actually in middle school that long ago. And I remember very clearly that lots of students were talking about sexual activities that they were engaging in starting around that time. And it's not uncommon for that to be something that kids are engaging in when they're, you know, around 11, 12 to start experimenting. And so it's really important that when students are just starting to form these types of sexual attitudes and getting used to engaging with other people in that intimate way, that they are learning how to do it the right way and not getting off to the wrong foot. It's also really important that not only are we addressing this issue in education and reforming our adjudication systems, but also that we change the way that sex is portrayed in media and in popular culture, since that's often the way that kids are being educated about these issues. Same goes with the pervasiveness of porn and how that is, in many ways, the new sex education for students. This hopefully will help combat some of that, some of the negative images that kids are getting.
Okay. And so what have you heard in terms of any opposition to this legislation? The background material I looked into seemed to suggest that, you know, this had relatively full support within the legislature. Mm-hmm. Of course, the governor signed it into law. What's your take on that? Was there opposition that that hasn't been covered, or was this truly one of those things that just kind of sailed through?
Honestly, this legislation, I was pretty surprised that this was so widely supported. It was almost unanimous. I think it was one vote shy of being unanimous in the California state legislature. And it was a similar margin for the affirmative consent standard that was passed a year ago. So this actually does have quite broad support. And I think part of that is because so many people can see themselves being connected to a situation that is what we're talking about here, right, which is sexual assault, either being the parent of a student who's been sexually assaulted, or being a survivor yourself, or being a friend of someone who's been assaulted. These are issues that are so pervasive that I think that in this particular instance, this is something that people realize it should not be bound by partisan politics.
Did this happen? You may not know the details of this, but I'm curious. Did this happen during the special session when the Right to Die legislation also passed?
I think it was prior to that, but I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. All right. We'll see if we can get some information on that during the hour. And then my next question is, okay, so the legislatures seem to be on board with this, or mostly. Have you seen, heard, or had to field any opposition from other groups outside of Sacramento? For example, you know, organized religion or other areas?
Actually, no. I've also been happy to see that there hasn't been very much opposition on any front. I think part of that, again, is because so many people can see this situation hitting close to home and being very painful for folks to go through. And so I think that there has been less opposition because it's starting to be seen as something that happens to you as opposed to being something that you're willingly engaging in. So I think that it's a different mindset from sex, and that people, I disagree with this, but people think that, oh, well, you can be abstinent. Whereas with sexual assault, it is not the fault of the victim, and I think people are starting to increasingly recognize that we need to take stronger action on this.
So it's really a different conversation. So last question for you. As I mentioned in my intro, the affirmative consent law came along at the same time as the mandatory sex education in public schools for grades 7 through 12. I imagine this wasn't an accident. How do you see the interplay between these two laws?
Well, I think that honestly they are very interconnected, in that sex is a part of many people's healthy relationships and lifestyles. I think that we are trying to destigmatize the conversation around sex and ensure that more people are starting to be less afraid to talk about this subject and to feel like it's something that can be discussed and to be able to get rid of the taboo that is related to these issues. As for whether there was any particular coincidence or not a coincidence, I'm not familiar with that, but I certainly think that this is a part of a broader social goal to get our societies to be more inclusive and understanding of these issues and to be more supportive to survivors.
Very good. Well, Sophie Karasik, thanks for hanging in there despite the technical difficulties and for giving us a broad overview of the two pieces of legislation that we'll be talking more about throughout this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So again, that was Sophie Karasik, an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of End Rape on Campus, a nonprofit organization working to end sexual violence on college campuses. And she's a recent graduate of UC Berkeley and was also an advocate for California's affirmative consent law, which was passed or signed into law, I should say, on October 1st by Governor Brown, in addition to a mandatory sex education for public high school middle and high school students in California. And so that's the topic of our conversation this evening. And as I was for a moment there connecting with Shafia, so you've been doing this work for 20 years, Shafia Zaloom at the Urban School. What does this moment mean for you as an educator?
I think it legitimizes what we've been trying to teach all along and the importance of it, that having healthy relationships is something we need to address with young people. Sexual development is a normal process that all young people experience, and I think we need to be braver about how we talk to them about this, and that this brings attention to this very real issue in a way that legitimizes it like it hasn't in the past. I think that it really is a moment to embrace and a time in which the tides will change so that there's more consistency in regards to comprehensive sexuality education on a national level.
Hmm. And Hannah Pastrano, you are a City College student who works as a peer educator for Expect Respect San Francisco, which I want to definitely hear more about. What does this legislation mean to you and the work that you are already doing in the San Francisco Unified School District?
It's really exciting because just a couple of years ago, the new curriculum came out for Be Real, Be Ready. I'm not sure, Chris, do you know?
Yeah, Be Real, Be Ready is our comprehensive sexuality curriculum that we use in San Francisco Unified, and Expect Respect is written into that curriculum. It's been in place for three years now, and we've had a couple of revisions, but Expect Respect has been a trusted partner throughout that process.
So you were saying?
And I was just saying that it's so exciting to see that so quickly after we got it part of all San Francisco public high schools, now the whole state of California is on board. And I'm just hoping to see that progress continued throughout all 50 states. Mm-hmm. It's really an important conversation to have. And like she was saying, you know, we need to be brave about it. And I love to do it. I love my job. I love talking to students, especially freshmen, about this in a way that shocks them. It's like, yeah, we're having this conversation today. And they're always like, whoa, like, did she just say healthy sex? What? I thought we were talking about relationships. Like, no, we're going to talk about rape. We're going to talk about a lot of really deep subjects, right? And, you know, we always tell them, make sure you take care of yourself. If you don't feel comfortable being here, step out. But join us when you're ready, because we all need to hear this.
So if it wasn't for you, Hannah, or you, Shafia, and in a few moments we'll hear about you, Christopher. Where would kids be getting this information, if at all?
Facebook.
Their friends. Pornography. The internet.
Often students just don't have a trusted source of information, so they make up stories, they hear things from their friends, and they just pass along a lot of misinformation. So a lot of my job as a health educator has often been correcting misunderstood information or half-true information mm-hmm. that young people have heard from another young person, or sometimes from adults who haven't had access to correct information themselves.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Where are the parents here in this process? Is I don't know that it's ever been something that parents have embraced, but are we seeing a changing relationship between parents and their kids around sex or sex talk about sex? You look like you wanted to jump in there, Hannah.
I was just going to say that a lot of times kids don't have that conversation at home. And like Chris said, there's a lot of information, misinformation that comes from their peers. And so part of what we do is we dispel myths. That, you know, that's what we call it. We're dispelling myths about rape and about sexual violence because they have heard things that are not true and that need to be talked about in an educational setting so they know they're getting good information. We know that because it's happening, right? Kids are having sex. Kids, some are. Some are being assaulted. And I mean, when you go into a freshman class and people, you know, write to us in their evaluations that they've been through situations of sexual assault or of rape, it's like, I think that it would
be
almost...
And to be clear, these are high school freshmen. Just to be clear. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think it'd be impossible for a parent of any student to say that, you know, this is too much information for their child when it's... How could it be if other kids their age are going through it?
But you seemed to suggest there, Christopher, a moment ago, that the kids are also getting misinformation from the adults in their lives.
Sometimes that happens. Sometimes adults haven't had access to good scientifically based information about their bodies and about how their bodies work and how things like sexually transmitted infections or pregnancy occur. And sometimes misinformation is passed on or maybe not passed on clearly to a young person so that the young person doesn't understand what the adult is trying to communicate. So
that makes me think about you, Shafia, because in your bio, it says here that you also work on parent health education.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that, because I imagine all these efforts that all of you around the table are interested in advancing are, you know, could potentially be, you know, stymied or perhaps not have its full impact if when the kids go back home, they're getting a different set of the different understanding about what they're hearing in school. So tell us about what you do at Urban School that has parents in mind when it comes to this topic.
We educate parents on what we're actually teaching their kids so that they can have conversation with them about it. We actually try to encourage them seeing it as an opportunity and a catalyst by which they can have these conversations, what they're learning in health class, what they are being exposed to at school through the lens of our class. Parents in the health education... I think being a parent is really challenging. I have three kids myself. I understand that. And I think parents have really good intentions. And I also believe that the majority of sex education is about values and understanding what your values are. And the majority of those actually come from parents. So parents have a really important role in all of this. And we need them to be on board and to partner with us in educating kids about their sexuality and their emerging sexual identities. And so what we do is we invite parents to engage in thoughtful conversation. And that doesn't mean we have to agree, but it means that we have to commit together to having conversations with the kids about this topic. And so I provide parents, much like I do, you know, for the kids, with medically accurate, credible resources so that they medically accurate information and credible resources so that they can inform themselves, because looking back historically, they haven't had the sex education that we're talking about right now either. And then suggestions as to when they can actually approach this topic, because we really want parents to be askable. A lot of parents, when you teach a comprehensive sex education class, think, oh, great, it's such a relief. I'm off the hook. I don't have to have this conversation. And actually, it's not that at all. In fact, I would hope they would more, because I would never take it upon myself to teach their values to their kid or my values to their kid. That's for them to do. I help their kids understand what those values are, but they really need to come from family. And so we encourage parents to figure out what those values are. They've probably been teaching them to their kids all along, and then how to actually communicate what those values are and make the concrete bridge to the context of sexuality and relationships and how those values play out in those relationships within this different context.
Mm. So, Christopher, I was going to turn to you because I'm curious how sounds like SFUSD started, revamped its curriculum about 3 years ago. How have parents in the school district responded to the shift?
When parents have been generally very supportive of our health education initiatives. When I started doing sex education in public schools, I actually expected a lot of resistance from parents. And instead, I've heard much more from parents saying, thank goodness you're talking to my child about this. I just don't know where to start. And I really encourage them to use the fact that they're in a health class, that we're going to be talking about sensitive issues. We talk about sexuality, but we also talk about substance use, drinking and drug use and exercise and nutrition, and that those are all things that people have values about, and that the main teacher of values in a child's life is their family. And so I really encourage parents to use the fact that their child's in this class and they're talking about these issues to be that moment where you start having those discussions. And adults are sometimes looking for the time to have the talk, and we really don't want people to have a single talk, but a series of talks and an ongoing conversation about these issues. And when students are talking about them in school, that's a great time to start sharing your own values and saying, this is how I feel about teen pregnancy. This is how I feel about relationships and when I think you should start dating and what would be important in a partner. Those are all things that adults can share their values about.
And so did you want to add anything more to what Shafia was just saying about just how to get parents engaged in that?
Well, we have wellness centers in all of our high schools, and our wellness centers often are doing outreach to parents, and we really partner in our health classes with wellness centers. So in many of our high schools, either the health teacher or the wellness center, or sometimes both parties in combination, will do parent nights. We'll do outreach to parents. They can do individual consultation with parents to talk about the health issues that are going on in the lives of young people.
I'm going to take a station break for just a second. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the recent changes to sexual education here in California with our guests, Christopher Pepper, a teacher with the San Francisco Unified School District, Shafia Zaloom, a health educator at the Urban School, a private school here in San Francisco, and Hannah Pastrano, a City College student who works as a peer educator with Expect Respect San Francisco, offering healthy relationship workshops to high school freshmen in the San Francisco Unified School District. And earlier by phone, we were joined by Sophie Karasik, an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of End Rape on Campus, a nonprofit organization working to end sexual violence on college campuses. So it's time to invite you, our listeners, into the conversation. What do you like or dislike about the new standards you've been hearing about governing sexual health education? How do you feel about teenagers being introduced to these topics in school? Is affirmative consent, or yes means yes, an appropriate standard to be teaching teens? And do you have questions for our guests about the tools they use to teach sex education to high school students? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's go back then to the second piece of legislation that was signed into law last month, which makes a sex education a requirement to middle and high school students in public schools in California. How do these two laws, this law and the affirmative consent law, work together, and where do they overlap? And I want to stick with you, Christopher Pepper.
Sure. So Assembly Bill 329 is a big change for San Francisco education, or for California education code, in that health education and particularly sexuality education will be mandatory for middle and high school students throughout California. And the sexuality education is required to be comprehensive, which means that it includes medically accurate information, it includes information about healthy relationships, and discussion of sexually transmitted infections, discussions of birth control options and pregnancy options, and a slew of issues that are involved with relationships and sexuality. Before that, it was really mixed across California. Some cities and counties would do a great job with health education in the classroom, and some places would not really have any sexuality education in the classroom. So this is making things much more universal across our state. About 1 in 8 public school students in the United States goes to school in California. So this is a really California leading the way in creating a comprehensive sexuality curriculum and comprehensive sexuality putting comprehensive sexuality in place for all students.
And it was parents, I believe, in the Clovis Unified School District who spearheaded spearheaded this expansion to include scientifically based and comprehensive sexual education, because in their school district, my understanding was that abstinence only was the only model being taught. So that this is an example, of course, of parents taking the other route here of pushing the line on this. So that's one example. But one of the provisions of the law is that parents can opt out of children receiving this education. Now, is this all of the sex ed or just the affirmative consent? Do you happen to know?
Parents can choose to opt out of any part of sexuality education. I honestly have not encountered very many parents who've chosen to take their students out of the sex education class at a high school level. It is something that a lot of parents do feel like they need some support in teaching about these topics. It's something that a lot of parents find challenging. So having a trained teacher who has the professional skills to answer sensitive questions well and with medically accurate, up-to-date information is something that a lot of parents really appreciate.
How about in other parts of the state, though? Would you see that this opt-out might be used more often than it might be used here in San Francisco or elsewhere in the Bay Area? Any thoughts from the other panelists?
I think we're going to have to see how things play out.
Time will tell. Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely across the state, there are cultural shifts. And I think there are differences in culture and perspectives in regards to what should be focused on. And so we need to see. The bill is so fresh. I think things are so new that the new law that we actually have to wait and see how it starts to unfold.
And so part of this is not only sexual health and navigating relationships, it's also teaching about marriage and family and the spectrum of sexual expression to include LGBT issues. And tell us more about how that is a shift in California sexual education. It may, again, not be a big shift for the people around this table, but what's your sense statewide?
I think over time we've recognized the need to talk about, when we talk about healthy relationships, we have to talk about all types of relationships. And in every classroom that I've taught in, there have been students who've been gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. Sometimes the teacher knows those students. Sometimes the teacher does not know those students. And my job as a teacher is to reach all the students who are in the room and give them information that's accurate and tailored for them. So I think it's really important that we have education that's inclusive of LGBT students. And I think our society has been rapidly evolving in our acceptance of LGBT young people, and young people are coming out earlier and earlier. And to be comprehensive, we really need to include all the students in that education. There may be some resistance as that rolls out across the state, but I honestly think that our parents and our young people are evolving on that issue very quickly, and I think it may roll out without a lot of opposition in that regard.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing recent changes to sexual education in California with Christopher Pepper of the San Francisco Unified School District, Shafia Zaloom of the Urban School, and Hannah Pastrano, a City College student and peer educator with Expect Respect San Francisco. We invite you, our listeners, to dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you have questions or comments about this new legislation, you can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's shift to how you take again or have taken this content and put it into practice in the classroom. So let's start with you, Shafia Zaloom of the Urban School. What considerations do you have to take into account as you try to broach these types of topics with kids who either are not hearing about it at all or hearing about it from sources that are questionable or perhaps not more worse than that, and in areas that are very kind of sort of uncomfortable at times? How do you bring these types of heavy topics into a seventh grade classroom?
Keep it real. I think that's the mantra, and I think that's what young people really appreciate. For them to share openly, young people need to know that there are certain community norms in the classroom, that their peers will suspend judgment, that they will commit to being respectful and active listeners, that they have license to fumble, and that there are no absolutes or ultimatums that are going to be put in place, because the real education happens when they share with each other in authentic and meaningful ways, because they're the ones who are sort of growing together and evolving together and understanding all of this and in relationship with each other. So I think that's really important. I have two approaches. The first is sex information. So providing the medically accurate sex information that kids need, pointing them in the direction of resources so that beyond the classroom they can access it as they evolve and gain more of an experiential context in their lives. In addition to that is the sex education part, which is how to actually apply all of that information to real life. So the complexities of human relationships, which is really important. And also to foster an awareness in them of self.
So you mean there really is a manual on relationships?
So really it's up to them. It's really an exploration of understanding, you know, who they are as people and how their sexual identities are emerging and what that means for them as they relate to each other and explore it with different folks. So it really is sort of a fluidity that we're talking about and open dialogue, which is what we're trying to encourage them to experience and practice.
Hannah, you want to add something there?
Because they want to talk about it.
Yes.
They do. They're so willing and ready to have that conversation as long as, like you were saying, it's an open, safe environment. And the teacher has everything to do with that. I mean, I can think of four or five health teachers in the classes that I go to where you can tell as soon as you walk in how those students trust that teacher and how comfortable and confident they are to share what they think with each other, with their teacher, with us as guests in their classroom. And just they do an amazing job at a lot of San Francisco schools.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, Hannah, when I was asking about where else would kids be getting this information, you mentioned pornography. Or was it you, Shafia? Now, you're pointing fingers at each other. Well, both of you, and perhaps Christopher as well. Do you address pornography in these classes?
Absolutely.
And how do you address it?
Well, I think being, again, keeping it real and being straightforward and honest about porn's presence out in social media. I think kids come across porn even without even intending to.
Exactly.
You Google something and suddenly all these other things come up, whether they were looking for it or not. I also want to say that it's really natural and normal for kids to be curious and to be looking for resources that will help them understand sexuality because so many adults aren't giving them that information. And so they take it upon themselves. There's no curator of porn. There's no Yelp of porn. It's kind of a free-for-all. And so, you know, as kids, and we could approach it neurologically too, as kids are establishing patterns of behavior and their sexual identities are emerging, to expose themselves without experiential context to pornography and what it creates in regards to expectations, how gender roles, there's also the porn world versus real world is how I approach it. This is what porn world actually represents, and this is what real world is. And let's talk about the disconnect and why it's insidious. And whether porn is right or wrong is a family value that I don't go into. It's more my concerns as a health educator who want kids to have healthy relationships in their lives, sort of how this sets them up and creates obstacles to that. So it's really about sort of discussing that and exploring it and providing them with alternative understandings of what real-life relationships are like.
Christopher?
I think that's very much the right track. One of the ways that I've found helps young people understand the difference between pornography and real life is talking about other types of movies that they might encounter. So what's the difference between a Fast and the Furious movie and driving over to see your relatives? That it's one is real life and one is Hollywood special effects. It's got a lot of embellishments. It's got a lot of editing and things that you couldn't do in real life. And it might be fun to watch, but it doesn't really teach you how to drive.
I love that comparison. That's great.
There's also a lot of research and science that's now coming out around pornography and how it's changed over the years because it's different from when we were younger. You know, it's now a multi-sensory experience for kids if they're looking at it online. It's no longer a still image that you have to engage your imagination in. It's actually a multi-sensory experience. And so there are studies, too, in regards to arousal addiction and a lot of different things that have to do with viewing porn at a young age and how it impacts kids' expectations and sexual identities.
And it's everywhere. It's not like you have to go on PornTube or whatever it's called. It's everywhere. So, you know, our advertisements today, like the sexual component of just media in general is so unavoidable.
Statistically, children, teenagers in particular, are exposed to 100 different references to sexuality a day.
So let's stay with this media piece, right? So we were talking about pornography, which you can stumble upon or not on the internet. Then, of course, there's the dreaded cell phone, right? And texting or sexting. How does that come into the conversation? Hannah, do you want to say anything about that?
I mean, I just feel like the more avenues we have to communicate, the more there is potential for people to use them to be abusive, unfortunately. And the sad reality is the faster we can communicate, we've got Facebook, we've got, you know, sexting, texting, all that kind of stuff. I actually completely stay off social media, so someone else might have more input than I do on this topic.
Well, I think we shouldn't be afraid of this topic. We need to really talk about what does it mean to send someone a text message. It could be a really great way to communicate with someone. It could be a way to tell someone that you're thinking about them. It can also be a way to really assert control over someone. So we talk about the difference. What does it mean when someone sends you 3 text messages a day versus someone who's sending you 60 text messages a day? If someone's checking on you before you get into class, after you get into class, and saying, where are you? How come you haven't gotten back to me?
Taking the phones. I think phones are a huge privacy issue between students. Their boyfriend or girlfriend really wants to check their phone to make sure they're not XYZ, whatever it is they're worried about.
Surveillance, so to speak. So what I'm hearing in these comments around sexting and pornography is it's out there. Let's be, you know, open and upfront about it. And how do you not, you know, avoid them, but how do you navigate them in a way that's healthy?
Mm-hmm.
So do you happen to know, Christopher, if the affirmative consent reaches beyond physical sexual content and to things like, let's say, texting or phone sex or other ways that people may be engaging?
Well, I don't have the text or the bill in front of me to see how that's written out, but the way that we've addressed this in San Francisco Unified is really to embed consent into a whole unit about relationships and sexuality. So we start talking about consent and relationships by talking about how to approach someone respectfully. So you see, you know, talking to a young person, if they see someone who's attractive and they want to go up and talk to them and maybe make plans for going out, how could you do that in a way that's respectful? How could you do that in a way that's not respectful and play that out, do some role playing, and then actually practice, okay, someone says yes, then what do? You've got to figure out where you're going to go. You have to agree on a place. If one person says they want to go for sushi and the other person says, I don't like sushi, maybe you're not going to go out on a date with that person. You have to find places to compromise and really starting with things that are lower risk than trying to negotiate sex between two people. Start with, let's go out to eat and figure that out and make some plans together and then really talk about consent all the way through and have a repeated message that as you're learning about anatomy and learning about sexual function, that that young people learn that they're in charge of their body. No one should be touching them if they don't want to be touched, and they have their own ability to advocate for the way that they'd like to be treated.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing recent changes to sexual education in California with the passage and signing of two new laws, one which is mandating sex education in public high schools and middle schools in the state, and the second which is also mandating affirmative consent education in those health classes. And we have guests here like Christopher Pepper from the San Francisco Unified School District, Shafia Zaloom, health educator at the Urban School, and Hannah Pastrano, City College student and peer educator. The number to dial to join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Hannah, you wanted to add something there.
Just on the subject of consent and cell phones, texting, I think it's really important that kids know that, you know, just because you're talking to someone over your texting about, you know, we call it sexting, I guess, that's not necessarily the same thing as getting consent right there and then and there in the moment. Just because you guys talked about it earlier, consent is something that happens in the moment, and it's something that needs to be ongoing throughout the entire process. You know, if someone at any point says stop, you have to stop. You have to respect them because you don't know why they're saying stop. There could be so many different reasons. Or maybe they've changed their mind since you texted them earlier. Maybe they're not down for everything they talked about. But you need to respect that.
Let's talk abstinence for a moment. How does that get addressed in your curricula? And both of you, Christopher and Shafia. Let's start with you, Shafia.
We absolutely talk about abstinence. We talk about the definition of the word. It's interesting because you can ask every student in the room to give their definition of abstinence, and there are all kinds of variations. And so I think we work under this big assumption that abstinence means the same thing to everyone, and it doesn't. And I think that's the number one lesson and the piece I try to get across. We also discuss abstinence. We discuss it as a value and what the kids think about it. We discuss why it's valued and important in the United States. We talk about, too, once they move beyond urban, what that means. If they are going to engage in sexual exploration with a peer who has had abstinence-only education and they have had something different, then what does that actually mean for their communication and their relationship and how important it is to be aware of that? We talk about the benefits of abstinence. We talk about how it is the only 100% foolproof way to avoid sexually transmitted infections and unplanned pregnancy. So, you know, we explore it as we do all the other options that are out there for kids when making decisions for themselves in their lives.
Christopher.
Well, in San Francisco, our health classes are generally taught at ninth grade, and we talk about abstinence a lot in those classes. As Sophia was saying, it's the most reliable. It's a method for avoiding sexually transmitted infections and pregnancy. It's the only way to be 100% sure that those things are not going to be part of a teenager's life. So we say that, and we also emphasize that most of their peers at that age are not having sex. And sometimes teenagers have the idea that everyone else is doing something and they're missing out. That's not the reality in our schools. In our schools, most of the students are not having sex. And we do talk about abstinence as a spectrum, or talk about sexuality as a spectrum, and that people can set limits, and that it's not abstinence means you don't have any physical contact with anyone, and sexually active means whatever goes. But that the reality, the way this works in most people's lives, is that they have some things that they like doing, some things they don't like doing, some things that they're ready for, some things they're not ready for, and so one person might say, I feel like kissing. The other person says, I like kissing too, but I don't like kissing with tongue. Well, that's a limit that you can set. And you can say, great, I'll kiss you, but I don't want to do anything more and I don't want to use a tongue. That's a limit, and that's a real clear example of a boundary that someone might have. And people have all kinds of boundaries. And most people who are sexually active adults have some things that they don't like to do, and that they maintain those boundaries.
So you mentioned that this education starts in the ninth grade in San Francisco Unified, and this law now says it starts at seventh grade. So how is the Unified School District preparing to expand into those earlier years?
Well, I'm really glad to say our school district has been on the forefront of this and has a three-year plan for moving health education as a separate class into our middle schools. And we started this year with the Willie Brown Middle School, having a middle school health class with a trained health educator leading that class. And we'll be rolling out into other middle schools over the next 3 years. As it is right now, our health education lessons are taught generally by science teachers. So we have teachers in middle school taking on those lessons, and we do professional development and training with them. And we're grateful for the work that they put in teaching those lessons, and we're looking forward to expanding and building on that.
And does your education already start in seventh grade?
No, we're just a high school.
You're just a high school.
We're okay. A high school. But there is, I mean, my own children and other kids I know in the Bay Area actually have health education in a lot of their schools at the middle school level as
I
well.
See. So how is this curriculum being adapted to the earlier years, or how do you see it being adapted across the state? Are there guidelines that are specific in the legislation that say exactly what has to be covered, or is that really left up to educators to decide? Or do they set sort of a minimum standard for different to make sure all counties are doing the same thing?
The education code sets out the expectations of what will be taught. And then it's up to individual districts to decide how they will meet those standards in the curriculum. For San Francisco Unified, we've created a partnership with the Adolescent Health Working Group for our high school lessons. So that is a consortium of programs like Expect Respect, the Department of Public Health in San Francisco, Planned Parenthood, Huckleberry Youth Programs, Hi-Fi, the Mission Neighborhood Health Center, UCSF, a lot of the nonprofits that work in our schools have all come together to really support a curriculum that was built together in community, and that's called Be Real, Be Ready. And since this law has passed, we've actually been talking to other school districts about looking at our curriculum, and it's available to them. We've had some people requesting to look at it, and they may start using it in other districts because it does meet most of the requirements for this new standard already.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Christopher and Shafia, if your phones are starting to ring, or you're getting emails from people asking you, who may know that you do this, you've done this already, to say, can you help us here where we're just getting started? Any requests so far?
Oh, yeah, a bunch. Absolutely. And it's really exciting. And I think that we're all in the spirit of this work, wanting to promote healthy relationships amongst young people. And so, you know, I'm super enthusiastic about collaborating with folks and sharing information. And so I have definitely done that. And also love seeing Be Real and Be Ready, and have looked at it and think there's a tremendous amount of value in it, and just think that all of it, in general, it's all entirely positive.
So we have a comment from Julie, who commented on the KLW website, asking for you, Hannah, to tell us more about Expect Respect. She says here, when you go into a classroom and talk about sexual violence, in relationships, are people enthusiastic, or some want to avoid it as they may have been victims? Or I guess the corollary to that I would add is, how do you create a safe space to bring up a topic when some people, this has hit home a lot more than for others?
Earlier we talked about the environment you create in the classroom, and it's really important to start with ground rules, right? And we don't spend a lot of time on it. We just go real quick, you know, that we want to listen. Like, we want to listen to you as much as you want us to listen. I mean, as much as you want to listen to us, right? So that we need them to talk to us and be open, and that we understand that certain students are going to have different responses, right? Sometimes classrooms look at you like you have three heads. They sit there and they don't say anything. And that's it's hard. That's difficult. But other times you have students who want to derail the conversation. And a lot of times, in the past, we have had teachers try to take these kids out of class, and we say, please don't, like, let them stay. We want them there because sometimes we feel that those might be the students that it's hitting closest to home. They're not ready to, or they weren't prepared to talk about it in class, but we want them to be here for it because if they're comfortable. Because even though they're trying to start a distraction, you know, like, they probably need it the most. Mm-hmm. We do find students who are really, really ready to talk about it, right? And they're active and they're excited that there's been a space provided.
Okay, we have in the last couple of minutes of the program, we actually have a call in here from Mikey, I believe, or Mickey, I can't tell. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. You have a question or comment for us?
Yeah, I was wondering if all the speakers could answer, if there's one thing that could be taught in sex ed that is currently missing from programs for middle schoolers, what they think it would be, especially for clarifying confusion about sexual assault and why it still happens.
Sure. And then I guess the producer was prompting me here also that you're interested in finding out what role high school students may have in reforming sex ed curricula as well. Is that one of your other concerns?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So let's in turn quickly here because we only have a few minutes. Shafia, Hannah, and then we'll end with you, Christopher.
I think a comprehensive discussion about traditional gender roles and stereotypical gender roles and how that can get in the way of young people having healthy relationships at the very basic level would be an essential element.
Hannah?
I agree. I think that starting with bullying, first of all, and also the gender roles and how that sets up what they're going to then learn in high school and what's going to happen in college.
So this is what's missing so far that could be added?
I think it does happen in pockets. I just don't know that it's consistent, which a law, you know, mandating that it would happen would do.
Okay. And Christopher, how could someone get involved as a high school student in helping to design curricula for their peers or for the seventh graders, for example?
Sure. Well, I think programs where young people are involved in the creation are often very strong programs, and they could use the fact that the education code in California is changing as of January 1st, really use that as a place to go to their communities and say, this is going to be the new requirement. Let's have education that's really sensitive and fits our community, and this is what we'd like to see. And
will USD be asking for student input on this education or people who want to be involved?
SFUSD has been... we've asked for young people's input along the way, and we will continue to be very open to the input and reflections of young people for all of our lessons.
And Expect Respect was actually started by high school students.
Well, there you go. All right. So, and I think we're going to have to unfortunately stop it there. Sorry, we got some calls at the last minute. Thanks. Sorry we couldn't get to you. But that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Christopher Pepper, teacher and on special assignment with the San Francisco Unified School District, working to coordinate the district's high school sexuality education and HIV prevention efforts, Shafia Zaloom, health educator at the Urban School in San Francisco, and Hannah Pastrano, City College student who works as a peer educator with Expect Respect San Francisco. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you for your interest.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney, and our senior producer is Susie Britton. Join me next Monday for a discussion of the challenges facing California's foster youth. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.